I'm tired as well.
Let's see. Okay. Okay, so I'm sorry I had to change the Zoom meeting idea. Actually found that figured out a way of getting the old Zoom meeting to work. The thing is, I can't really start it that easily. And so I've changed the Zoom meeting idea, which everyone who can hear me now has already figured that out. But I will go ahead and begin. By the way, this changing Zoom meeting idea. I don't know why I lost my ability to start the meeting with the original Zoom meeting idea. This, I hope, will remain the permanent Zoom meeting idea. That is, what is it? It's 943-1918-0577. It should be that for our lectures, at least for the first 2 weeks, and whenever we need Zoom, that will be the meeting ID that we use. Okay, so today what I want to talk about is quickly recap these salient points of lectures 1 and 2, where we talked about vectors as ordered lists of numbers and their geometric their operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition. I'm going to introduce a third operation, the so-called dot product, which is useful in getting geometric information out of ordered lists of numbers. And then we'll close today's lecture with the introduction of the basic geometric objects of linear algebra, which are really very simple. Nothing as exotic as even a sphere. The basic geometric object of linear algebra is just going to consist of points, lines, planes, and higher dimensional generalizations. Okay, one other remark. I said on Wednesday that the first homework assignment on WebAssign would be due Wednesday, January 19th, but in fact, I'm going to delay that until Friday, January 21st. So what that means is that you can use the upcoming weekend, the long one. We won't have class on Monday because of Martin Luther King Day. You can enjoy that. What I hope to do on Wednesday of next week, when we return from the weekend, will be to do a quick demonstration of how to use WebAssign. And we'll look at homework assignment 1. And then I'll leave you to complete that assignment by Friday. But that initial assignment is really short. It should only take you about 15 minutes to do. So that's where we are with homework. And let me then proceed with today's lecture. Remember that in this course, while we have alternative ways of thinking about vectors, as directed line segments, as quantities with magnitude and direction, etc., the principal way we'll understand vectors in this course, especially at the beginning of the course, is just as ordered list of numbers. And so we'll denote single vectors. Typically, for shorthand, I'll just denote it by a single letter. If I want to depict a letter, a letter D to depict a letter, on screen, it will usually appear as a boldface font. And if I'm writing on a scratch pad, I'll try to indicate vectors by writing a letter, but then putting a little arrow over the top to show that this is a vector. While if I had just a lowercase letter with no ornaments on it, that would just be a number typically. All right, so occasionally I'll draw pictures, but not so much. Let's see, some notation that we'll be using constantly throughout the semester is this capital R in this funny font. That's going to denote the set of real numbers. And when we want to talk about the set of all possible n-dimensional vectors, I'll denote that as that funny R with a superscript n. That n is going to indicate the dimension of our vectors, or the number of components in each ordered list. All right, and let me remind you also of our sort of set theoretic notation for this vector space Rn. So what I want you to look at is the right-hand side of this formula. The curly braces are indicating that we're looking at a set. Before that vertical line in the center, there's an object sitting there. It looks like an ordered list because of the square braces, and the individual items in that list are separated by commas. That vertical line in the center separates the objects in the set from the conditions that you place on them. And what we're requiring of these ordered lists of n objects is that each object in the list is a real number. All right, so that's a real technical explanation for saying that Rn is the set of all lists of n numbers. Okay. All right, so beyond that, we had two fundamental vector operations. The first we described as vector addition. We use the plus sign, just like if we were adding numbers. But in fact, what we're doing in this operation is we're taking two ordered lists of n numbers, combining them to produce a single ordered list of n numbers. And the way we do so is we take the individual components, first component v1, add it to the first component of the second vector u1, and that gives me the first component of the vector sum v plus u. And the second and third components are computed similarly. Likewise, we have a formula for scalar multiplication, wherein we take a number lambda, a list of n numbers, or a vector b, and the scalar multiple of the vector b by the number lambda is going to be the new list of n numbers we get by taking the old list and multiplying each element of the list by the number lambda. All right, now, we define those operations. Let me just give you a quick sample computation. One, two, that's a two-dimensional vector. If I add it to another two-dimensional vector. And by the way, I can only add two-dimensional vectors to two-dimensional vectors, three-dimensional vectors to three-dimensional vectors. You always have to have the same dimension if you're going to add them. That's because the rule is that you have to add similar components. So 1 plus minus 1 is 0. 2 plus 3 is 5. And that's the computation. And if I take 2 times this vector with two components, the result is going to be a vector with two components. I just multiply each of the original components by 2. All right, so those explicitly are those rules of vector addition and scalar multiplication performed on two-dimensional vectors. But of course, the rules apply to n-dimensional vectors as well. All right, so on this slide, I want to show you 8 fundamental properties of these two operations of vector addition and scalar multiplication. So the first one is that when we add two vectors, it doesn't make any difference as how we order them in that addition. U plus V is the same thing as V plus U. Well, we know that's true with numbers. Just remember that I'm adding vectors in this case. And so this is actually something we have to check. I have not yet verified that summing the two vectors in two different ways actually produces the same result. We'll check that in a second. But there are similar identities. If I'm going to add three vectors together, well, we're sort of in a quandary. I have a rule for adding two vectors, no rule explicitly for adding three vectors. And so I have to decide, should I add the first two vectors first to get a vector and then add a third vector to it to get a final result? Or should I add the latter two vectors first before combining it with the vector u? Now, there are mathematical operations in which the order in which you group things does make a difference, but it turns out for vectors it doesn't. This works out to be an identity. Similarly, if we add the vector with whose components are all zeros to any vector, we just get back the vector we started off with. Right? Let me show you that real quickly. Here, if I add 1, 2 plus the 0 vector, the rule is we add like components. But then what's going to happen here is you're just going to get back what you started off with, right? So this rule 3 is also true when we define addition in that fashion. And then we also, if we add the negative of a vector to itself, we always get the zero vector. Here we're showing that scalar multiplication, when I multiply a sum of vectors by a number, I can delay that scalar multiplication effectively until after I add the numbers. That's called distributive law for scalar multiplication. We can also add two numbers together and multiply a vector, and that turns out to be equivalent to adding scalar multiples of the two vectors to each other. So on the left, I add the numbers first and then do scalar multiplication. And on the right, I do scalar multiplications first before I add. And there's a similar rule for how we combine scalar multiplications. We can either do the scalar multiplications repetitively on a vector, or we can multiply the scalar factors first before applying it to a vector. And lastly, anytime we multiply a vector by one using scalar multiplication, we get back the vector we started off with. Now the thing to note about these rules is that my definitions only involve two vectors, and these rules are basically saying, given those definitions, there are some other simple identities that follow, and there are a total of eight of them. But let me show you one example of how we prove these things. They're all proved essentially the same way. What you do, for example, to show this identity, is you calculate it directly using ordered lists of numbers for both vectors u and v. Right? So if I write u as a list of numbers, and I write, sorry, this should have been v as a list of numbers, then u plus v, well, here's my rule for adding ordered lists of numbers. I add like components to one another to get a new ordered list of numbers. So that's just the definition of what it means to add these ordered lists. But then, because inside these lists, each component is a number, I can use the property of commutativity of real numbers. So u1 plus v1, you're definitely adding two real numbers. And so I can reverse their order of summation, and I can do that for each component. And then I can break this vector in the last line apart into two component vectors, but now v is preceding u, and the identity is thus proved. Okay, now, so I remarked in the first lecture, this is not a proof course, so you're not going to be expected to repeat similar proof for the other seven identities. Nevertheless, I bring out these formal points because it's going to be important later on. What we'll see is about midway through the course, anytime we have a set where we can define some notion of vector addition and scalar multiplication. You might recall that in the first lecture, I talked a bit about oscillations as being interpretable as vectors. Well, that the justification for thinking that is really the wave oscillations admit notions of vector addition and scalar multiplication. The vector addition of oscillations is like adding the instruments in an orchestra to get the total sound of an orchestra. And the analog is scalar multiplication when we're talking about sound waves or musical notes. It corresponds to changing the amplitude of the vibrations. And or if we multiply by a negative number, it also has, you not only change the amplitude, but you have the ability of reversing the phase of the oscillation. So there will be other sets, less concrete, oscillations or states of a hydrogen atom or solutions of a differential equation that are going to behave like vectors, not so much because the individual elements of the set look like quantities with direction and magnitude, but rather because of the way we have two operations to take pairs of elements of the set and produce a new element of the set, or we have a way of taking a number in an element of the set and producing a new element of the set. If these generalized notions of vector addition and scalar multiplication, if they satisfy the eight identities here. So now think of these identities as properties of a more general set, not necessarily order lists of numbers, but something a set where we can add and scalar multiply. If these rules still hold for that set, then in fact, what's going to happen is that set is going to behave exactly like Rn. And that's great because Rn is so concrete. It's just ordered lists of numbers. We'll be able to see very concretely how to combine or scalar multiply functions or ordered lists of oscillations or anything else that we want to interpret as a vector. And in fact, we'll be able to transport questions about abstract vectors into the calculational setting of Rn. All right, now that stuff, that sort of level of abstraction where we leave the safe confines of ordered lists of numbers and begin to think of more abstract vectors, that's coming about midway through the course. What you need to concentrate on now is this vector space Rn where we do calculations. Everything is going to be very concrete and calculable. When we move to more abstraction, then we are going to have a solid platform, this vector space Rn, for which we can then do calculations. Okay, so there's one other operation that we'll use for vectors that's quite important. It's the so-called dot product. Certainly engineers and physicists have seen the dot product. I'm going to describe it two ways. First, I'm going to give you the way we think of the dot product in the context of this course of linear algebra, where we admit vectors of arbitrary dimension. And then I'll give you a geometric way of thinking about the dot product, which is applicable in any dimension. It's just that you can't actually carry out the computation in any dimension because we won't have n-dimensional rulers and n-dimensional protractors to measure things with. Okay, so let me show you what's going on here. If you have a pair of vectors, so again, I introduced this notation in the first lecture, but anytime I have a set, say A, and I take another set B, and I take the Cartesian product, what this is, it's the set of all elements I can create, all pairs I can create by taking an element of A as the first element and taking an element of B as of the set B as the second element of that set. So the dot product here is a function that's going to take a pair of vectors and it's going to produce a number out of that vector, a real number. And so here's how it's done. Here are two ordered lists of numbers. The dot product is going to it's going to indicate the function we're going to apply, and here's its definition. The number that corresponds to the dot product of this list times the second list is going to be the first component of the first list times the first component of the second list. Added to that, the second component of the first list plus the second times the second component of the second list. Added to that, the third component times the third component, etc. All right, so here's a more tidy formula for the same thing. I'm subtly introducing my summation notation. What this symbol means is I'm gonna take this pattern where I have indicating elements of this list. I'm distinguishing them by their index, that is by these subscripts. And I'm taking the same element. The element in the same position in each list, multiplying them together, and then I'm summing over all the positions in the list. Okay, so that's the linear algebraic version of the dot product of two n-dimensional vectors. But there's also a geometric version, where instead of using ordered lists of numbers, we think of vectors as directed line segments. being directed line segments, they're going to have a certain length. We'll just lay a ruler down and measure it. When they're going to have a certain angle between them, you have two vectors, A and B, there's going to be an angle in between them, right? So in fact, in this geometric formula for A dot B, the way I would calculate A dot B is I would measure the length of one vector by laying down a ruler and measuring it, and measure the other vector. Then I have two numbers for the magnitude of A and the magnitude of B. And then I use a protractor to measure the angle. Use my calculator to calculate the cosine of that angle. And now I've calculated A dot B by measuring it, not so much by calculating it. Okay, so, but what's nice about this is that now I have a geometric version of an operation that we can perform very concretely. The advantage of that is, well, in two dimensions, where I can easily draw directed line segments, and I can easily set up ordered list of numbers, I'll have two different ways of computing the dot product. Either I can use geometric figures and rulers and protractors, or I can think of these guys as ordered lists of numbers and use the linear algebraic version of the dot product to compute the result. But the important point is whether I regard my vectors as directed line segments or ordered lists of numbers, no matter how I compute the dot product, either by the geometric formula or the linear algebraic formula, I'll get the same number as a result. So long as, well, let's make sure these vectors actually correspond. The vector corresponding to the ordered list, 2, 3, we get that directed line segment by going over two steps and up three steps.
Professor, we can't see what you're writing.
Sorry. So here's an ordered list of numbers. It corresponds to coordinates 2, 3. And the way I get a geometric vector out of this ordered list of numbers is simply drawing a directed line segment from the origin up to the point with those coordinates. So I've shown you how to pass between ordered lists and vectors. And my statement here is that when we compute dot products, since I can convert between ordered lists and directed line segments, at least on a piece of paper, I can either compute dot products of vectors using the linear algebraic formula or the geometric formula, but the result always will be the same number. Now, what's important about this is that this correspondence between ordered lists and directed line segments is only easy to show in two dimensions. If I had a four-dimensional vector, well, I can think about, abstractly at least, a directed line segment in a four-dimensional space, but I can't actually visualize it, nor can I draw it and measure it. And so what we use the geometric version of the dot product for is to give us intuition about what might be happening in higher dimensions. We'll still think of vectors as being directed line segments, even if we can't realize them explicitly as a directed line in a four-dimensional space. Something that we can see, touch, and hold, or something like this. It's not going to be that concrete. Rather, the most concrete way we'll have of dealing with four-dimensional vectors or higher dimensional vectors is to treat them as ordered lists of numbers. Nevertheless, we can extract geometric information from them because this geometric formula will allow us to interpret ordered lists of numbers geometrically. Let me show you how that works. You start with a geometric rule, and then every time you see a dot product, you replace it with the linear algebraic formula for the dot product. So for example, let me do this more slowly here. Here's a vector A. And let's think of it as an ordered list of numbers. All right, so what is the length of A? Well, rather than start with that formula, let me just write that A dot product with itself is equal to, on the one hand, it's A1 times A1 plus A2 times A2 until we've exhausted all the components of that vector. All right, so that's its dot product using the linear algebraic formula. But it's also equal to the length of A times the length of A times the cosine of the angle between the vector A and itself. Well, that angle is zero. The angle or distance between A and itself is zero. Cosine of zero is equal to one. And this is just the length squared. Okay, so what does that tell me? It tells me that I can calculate the square of the length by taking the dot product of the vector with itself. And now I can calculate the length of an n-dimensional vector, not by measuring it with a ruler, but rather by knowing its components, taking its dot product with itself, and then taking the square root of that. So in fact, solving for the length here, I have the length of A is equal to the square root of A dot with A, but let's write this out explicitly, and you see how I get it directly from the components of A. Well, that's showing up equals the square root of A1, A1 plus A2, A2 plus dot dot plus AN, AN. And some of you might see this as a generalization of the Pythagorean theorem. Right? This familiar picture about that Pythagorean theorem, if you have a triangle with sides x and y, then that hypotenuse is the sum of the squares of the components. So the length of this thing is actually the sum of the squares of the components. And this is a higher dimensional generalization of that simple geometric fact. Okay. So some of you are not seeing what I'm writing. I'm not sure if that's a recent comment, but you may, if I stop the share, you should be able to see it. That's what I've been writing. And there should be a window on your screen which is showing everything that's taking place on this pad of paper. Okay. So not only can we get the length of the vectors from this formula, but we can also get the angles as well. So you just start with this formula, and then you use it to solve for the angle. So what I do is I would divide both sides by these lengths, and then take the inverse cosine function to extract the angle out of this formula. And what you could then see is then replacing the dot product or writing the dot product as in the linear algebraic fashion, you see that even the angle can be directly computed from by knowing, or once you know the individual vectors A and B as in terms of their components, A1 through AN and B1 through BN. All right, so let's do some explicit calculations. Here's a four-dimensional vector. I've got a two-dimensional ruler. So it's not going to help me measure how long this four-dimensional vector is. But if I compute the dot product of A with itself, here's the linear algebraic version, and it works out to be 6. Then we apply the geometric rule that says the dot product of a vector with another vector is the product of the lengths times the cosine of the angle between them. And what this will work out to be is the length squared. If the length squared is equal to 6, that means the length of the vector itself is going to equal the square root of 6. Good. We've got the length of a four-dimensional vector, and we didn't even have to visit four-dimensional space in order to get its length. Similarly, if I have two four-dimensional vectors, and I want to know if the angle between those vectors, well, we start off by computing some dot products. We compute the square root of the dot product of A with itself, we get the length of A. The dot product of B with itself, the length of B. And then the dot product of A with B, well, given these components, it's going to work out to be 1. So now I'll take the initial formula, the geometric formula, A dot B is equal to the length of A times the length of B times the cosine of the angle, and I'll plug in for these values. The length of A was 2, the length of B was the square root of 7, and A dot B was 1. So then we have the extreme sides of the equation, and I can use that to solve for the angle. And what you find is that the angle between these two vectors, A and B, stated as ordered lists of numbers, is exactly, well, up to one decimal point anyway, is exactly 79.1 degrees. Okay, so the dot product is going to enable us to extract geometric information. And sometimes it's going to be useful. Sometimes we're going to want to know if two vectors sitting in a 10-dimensional space, whether or not they're perpendicular to one another, or whether or not there's some component of one vector going in the same direction as the other. Well, the dot product is going to be essential in allowing us to figure out what's going on geometrically. Okay. Oh, I see it zoomed in too much. I'm not sure I can adjust that, adjust the zooming. So I'll try to watch on screen my pad of paper to make sure everything I write is actually appearing on screen. Okay, so while we're talking about geometry, this is a good point to segue into the basic geometric objects that we'll use all the time in linear algebra. In fact, they're really very, very, very simple. Nothing even exotic as a sphere or a torus or a triangle or other things. Typically, the things we're working with are points, which are going to correspond directly to vectors, lines, which are going to be an infinite set of points, but there's be a certain pattern for a point to lie on a line. You have to be collinear, for one thing. And then we'll have higher dimensional generalizations of lines to planes, to three-dimensional spaces, to hyperplanes. So let me show you how these constructions go. First of all, the first thing we're going to do is regard points as corresponding to single vectors. This makes sense if you think about points in a three-dimensional space. Well, the way you would describe them is by giving their x, y, and z coordinates. The two coordinates in a plane, maybe x and y, and then a vertical component z. And once you've given those coordinates, you have at least described the location of a point in an in a three-dimensional space. Well, notice that x, y, z is an ordered list of three numbers, and that's what we're using to describe points in a three-dimensional space. Well, just by extending the analogy, if we want to talk about points in an n-dimensional space, what we should use are ordered lists of n numbers, because that's what we'll need to we'll need n numbers to coordinatize the points in an n-dimensional space. So, in the end, points are going to correspond directly to vectors. The vectors themselves are going to represent the coordinates of the points with respect to some origin. Okay, second object, the next stage of this development is to look at lines. Well, a line is an infinite set of vectors. Here's one way of getting a line. Let's start with a point, and let's pass through that point in a particular direction that we put that point actually on the line. Okay, so here's the geometric data that goes into specifying line. You take a starting point, and then you depart from that starting point in some direction D. And you're allowed to go arbitrary distance this direction or in the opposite direction. But you don't go off that line. You just stick to departing from this point either along this way or in the exact opposite way. All right, so here's the geometric, the linear algebraic construction of that same set. So let me actually help you think of this as a set of vectors. So here's my original line passing through this point. Let me call that point, this point here, let me call that a vector P0. That's better, I think. So there's a vector P0. And now let me put a direction vector D right adjacent to it. Well, then, let's see, I probably need a colored pencil, I think. Here we go. The vector sum of this vector P0 and D, that's done by starting at the base of the first summon and drawing a line that goes to the tip. And so this vector here, this red vector, is P plus D. Well, that's of the form of one of these points on this line L here. It's the point where T is taken to be the real number one. But to get other points along this line, I can make this contribution longer by multiplying it by a positive number, right? That's just gonna make the departure from the original point P0 a distance further along the same direction. Or if T is a negative number, well, what that does is it changes the length, overall length of the vector, but it could also reverse the direction. So I could have like a minus T times D. Think of T as being positive. That would be, if you go up to the plus D zero, that might be a vector that looks like this. So from here to here, that would be minus T times D. And then since I'm adding a vector to an initial vector, this would be the corresponding vector. And in fact, each point along that line, you should think of as the tip of an arrow that corresponds to a particular vector. All right, but this complicated drawing sort of betrays the simplicity of this formula. The way we get lines in linear algebra is we start at a given point, we choose a particular direction D, and we think of every point we can reach in the plane or higher dimensional space, depending on where P0 and D live. Every point we can reach by taking this particular linear combination of this form, that's going to constitute the line. It's going to be an infinite set of vectors because we're allowed to vary this parameter T. It could be any real number, and we collect them all together into a single set. All right, now, that's the way we'll think about lines in linear algebra, but of course, there's other ways of making lines. One way is to take two points in the plane. Here's a point. Well, given two points in the plane, there's always a unique line that passes through them both, right? So here's a geometric line. And how would I understand that as linear algebraic vectors? Well, what you do is it actually lies, each of these points, A and B, actually lie along this line. You see, call this A, call this B. If my line is a set of points of the form A plus T times B minus A, these are all vectors, and I'm going to let the parameter T vary over the entire real line. All right, now, this difference between A and B, think of that as a direction. So then the way I constructed this set is by taking a vector, another vector, multiply by an arbitrary number, and I collected, by varying that arbitrary number, I collect them all together, I get a set of vectors. Have a linear combination with a parameter that I can vary over the entire real line. That's a vector. But notice that if I set t equal to 0, this term doesn't contribute, and so that line certainly contains the point A. Now, on the other hand, if I set t is equal to 1, what's going to happen is I'm going to have A plus 1 times B minus A, and that's effectively A minus A is going to produce the 0 vector, and I'm just going to get B. So both the points B and A itself correspond to particular points along this line. The point A corresponds to the point where t is equal to 0, and the point B corresponds to the element of this set where t is equal to 1. All right, so you're given two points. You can write down a line, and in fact, you can express it in this fashion. Another way you have seen lines come up, particularly in your calculus courses, is you think of, you can think of a line in the sense of calculus. Rather than thinking of it as a graph, let's think of it as a parameterized curve. Each point here on this line is, we have a certain map that takes a number of t and produces an element of the plane. And when we write this set of points as, let's see, I'll write it out in components. Maybe 1 plus 2 times t plus 3 minus t. And I let that parameter t vary over the entire real line. So what's going to happen here is for each value of the parameter t, I get an ordered list of numbers, and so a two-dimensional vector. When we write vectors this way, you can think of it as a function that takes real numbers into two-dimensional vectors. And in that sense, it's in the language of calculus, what we're describing is a curve that happens to be a straight line. But even lines that are set up in this fashion still have this basic linear algebraic form. You could write this same set as 1, 3 vector plus a parameter t times the vector 2 minus 1. And you still just let t range over r, and now I've got a set, an infinite set of vectors that of the form of a single vector plus an arbitrary multiple of a different vector, exactly of the same form as this lowercase l on the slide. So in fact, this is going to always be true. No matter how a line is formulated, we'll always be able to cast that description into the standard way we denote lines in linear algebra. Right, now, in this last section I'm just describing, you have a function from the real numbers into a vector space in which each component is a linear function of the parameter t, you're going to get a line. But you'll be nevertheless be able to write the n-dimensional vectors that are the points along the line, you'll be able to take this formula and re-express it in this fashion. The reason why I'm emphasizing this way of formulating the line is because it generalizes so easily and readily to higher dimensional objects. For example, a plane. A plane is going to be a similar construction. We start at a point P0, but if instead of straying from it in just one direction, d1, we allow ourselves an additional direction from which we can depart the point P0. So in this description of a plane, we start with a point. We can leave that point in one direction, D1, or separately, we can go in a different direction, D2. And in fact, now we allow ourselves to go in either direction, you know, or even in the opposite of a given direction, an arbitrary distance. Using those two directions, we can actually reach any point on the two-dimensional plane. So the way you get that is, if you want to reach this point, you take a scalar multiple of this first vector, making it a little bit longer, say t, d1, and I make this vector, maybe make it a little bit longer, call that now s, d2, and then what will happen then, if I draw this parallel appropriately, this side is parallel to d2, this side is parallel to d1, as indicated, because they're scalar multiples of one another, and then I can reach this point on the line by taking a scalar multiple of the second vector and adding it to a scalar multiple of the first vector. All right, so that's how you generate every point in the plane using two different directions. And that construction is readily generalized to higher dimensional, what we would call hyperplanes. They're just constructed in a similar fashion. We start at a point and depart from that point along a fixed set of directions, but arbitrary distances along each of those directions. That will end up filling out the space, and it will be a higher dimensional analog of these two-dimensional planes. In fact, even our lower dimensional examples can be thought as a type of hyperplane. So for a point, which consists of a single vector, we just stay at the initial starting point. We don't stray from it at all. The line is a set of the same form as this general hyperplane. It's just that we only have one direction from which to depart our giving starting point. A plane will have two directions from which we can leave this. And in general, a higher dimensional hyperplane is going to have a starting point and a set of, let's say, k different directions from which we depart. That would be, as long as these directions are distinct from one another, a k-dimensional hyperplane. Okay, so let's see, I have 2 minutes left. I was going to relate linear equations to hyperplanes, but given I only have 2 minutes left and we have a long weekend before us, before we meet again on Wednesday, I'm going to delay this portion of the today's lecture until next Wednesday. I do want to point out, though, again, that the first WebAssign problem set, I initially assigned it and had it due on Wednesday, January 19th. It is now due on Friday, January 21st. What I intend to do in class, at the beginning of class next Wednesday, will be to boot up WebAssign and to show you how you answer WebAssign problems so everyone can do their homework. If you actually look at problem set one, you can probably complete it now, as long as the syntax for entering problems is clear. And in fact, it should only take you about 15 minutes to do. So I'm delaying problem set one, not so much because it's a long assignment, but rather because I want to explicitly demonstrate how to use WebAssign in lecture. Okay. So let me stop here, and I wish you a long and, if not productive, a happy Martin Luther King Day weekend, and I will see you again next Wednesday.